Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We come to you once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa. Well, Donna, I learn something every day. This past week, I partook of some lovely green chili. It was a pork chili, just really heavy on the pork and the chilies. It was very good. But I learned a new word. I learned a new term. Donna, what is a mangalista?
Sounds like a utensil, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It's a breed of pigs. From Hungarian originally, a very old breed from the 1800s that was practically extinct into the 60s or 70s or something. Into the 90s. So it's a recent resurgence. Now, how this pig became extinct is because there are fashions in pig raising, right? And of course, the mangalista and another breed we're going to talk about later, but particularly the mangalista are known for its amount of fat. Now, before we had fats like olive oil everywhere or vegetable oils, people in northern climates had to rely on animal fats for all the fats in their diets and for lubricants and for all kinds of things. So, you know, there was butter, there was tallow, which is the beef fat. But the pigs were the big, big fat producers. So a pig like a mangalista, which has a very high percentage of fat and really excellent fat in terms of that it can be whipped, it can be, you know, those were in high demand. And the meat quality is also excellent. But the quantity of fat made it a very popular breed in the 1800s. And then as our need for fat diminished, people stopped raising them because the fat, lard has become almost a waste product now, you know. But they're gorgeous pigs. They have curly hair.
Yes, pictures of mangalista pigs. They sort of are even referred to as sheep pigs sometimes. And as I understand it, Donna, they are coming back into favor because they are being crossbred with other things. That the pork green chili that I had this last week was half mangalista, half something else.
Duroc. It was a Duroc.
Yeah, it was very good.
Because the mangalista, and this is probably true of other breeds, it's called a land sticking breed. It means that the breed really does well in the land where it was, you know, developed because of either the climate, the diet, the da 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 da. And so they found when they tried to take mangalista to other places, they did not thrive as well. So they're being crossed and now they were nearly extinct and now they've been bred out and they're bringing back sort of fancy pigs at high-end restaurants, you know.
Very
and
good.
Yeah, for wonderful for the Hungarian cuisine, which is very fat heavy and, you know, lots of sausages and things like that. So we had a little mangalista fun this weekend. But today on the show, we are bringing another kind of pig to your attention. So with us we have
Ray Schmidt
from FarmStoryMeats.com. Now, Ray's father, Randy, grows Chester white pork. So, welcome, Ray.
Yep, thank you for having me.
Tell us about growing up with Chester white pork and what it is.
So, like Mangalista, Chester white is also considered a heritage breed, but instead of originating in Hungary, it actually originated in Pennsylvania in the early 1800s. So my dad's been very passionate. I guess when he got started raising pigs in the 1960s, he fell in love with the breed, really liked the way they had good maternal ability, good meat quality, and they're also known for being pretty docile and, well, easy to get along with and easy to raise.
Well, I have to say they taste pretty good, too.
Oh, my.
So you have, tell us about then Farm Story Meats and what your business is.
Yeah, so Farm Story Meats is a direct-to-consumer meat company. Growing up on the farm, I saw my dad work really hard to raise high-quality Chester White pigs. Everybody said how good the meat was, but they just go to the local commodity market and end up who knows where. Likewise, at the end of supply chain, you go to a grocery store, pick up a pork chop, and have no idea where it came from. So my goal with Farm Story Meats is to connect the farmer with the customer. And we've expanded to include some of our neighbors' beef, and then we've also partnered with some pasture-raised poultry to provide chicken, turkey, and eggs, and we also have lamb.
Yeah, I had lamb for the Easter. It was really, really good. Oh, nice. So people in Central Iowa can order from your Farm Story Meats and have it delivered directly, right?
Correct. So we do free delivery in Ames, Nevada, Boone, Story City, Ankeny, and the Des Moines metro area. So ordering off the website is, I think, pretty easy. And then it'll come the following Monday or Tuesday. And then actually anybody anywhere in the country can order from our website and have it shipped directly to them, whether it's UPS or FedEx. We use insulated boxes and dry ice to get the frozen meat there, and it'll arrive frozen, and we've shipped as far as Boston and San Diego, and we even have a very avid Alaska customer that keeps ordering from us.
Well, I mean, after all, Iowa pork, we're known for it, and I have to say, yours is pretty good.
Good Iowa pork.
So tell us about, well, the breed. How did your father start?
For those of us who don't know all that much about pigs, how big is a pig, and how long does it take to grow?
So genetics have been, improving in recent years. But a lot of people have, like you mentioned with the lard, kind of going back to some of those old-timey breeds that maybe did contain a little more fat content. So if you look at pigs from maybe the early 1900s or 1800s, they're a lot different shape than they are now. So now the pigs are more bred to get to market quicker, so it's a better return on the investment for the farmer. But there is kind of a revert back to some of those classic breeds that do contain qualities of things that are coming back into popularity. So with the Chester White breed in particular has kind of a fun story to it. It was developed from some English breeds in eastern Pennsylvania, and there is a county fair where they wanted to officially make the breed a purebred, but they didn't know what to name it yet. So the rule was, or the competition was between two farmers, and whoever won more blue ribbons that year at the county fair would get a name the breed of pig. Well, the two farmers won the exact same amount of blue ribbons. So then they looked to the judge, and the judge just named them the Chester County Whites. So
the county?
Because it was based in Chester County, Pennsylvania, and then throughout the years, they dropped the county part, so they became known as Chester Whites. So they're a larger pig. Market weight's about 250 to 300 pounds. Takes them about 6 months to get that large.
Six?
That's pretty fast.
Oh, my God. Right? Good
yeah,
for them.
They're white with droopy ears, and a lot of them have blue eyes as well. So,
well, and the white pig is what, it's the classic, you know, you think of the little pink piglets, and that's kind of what they look like. It's your classic. On your website, Farm Story Meats, there are pictures of all the animals. They just look adorable. So, and here's why I'm so excited about Farm Story Meats. You sell pork feet. It's really hard to get a you can get a commodity pork foot, you know, that's been produced anonymously somewhere in some CAFO. And
well, Donna, you don't know where that pork foot's been.
That's exactly okay. Right. But your pork feet, first of all, they're enormous and they're gorgeous. So thank you for marketing pork feet.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm happy to. It's been nice to partner with some great family processors that are willing to do things like pig feed, because not all of them are, because unfortunately a lot of aspects of pork production and any animal processing, a lot of them are waste. So people end up throwing a lot of the organ meat and feet and bones out. But
and fat,
our stance is, our stance is we want to best honor the animal. The animal gave its life for us to eat it. So we keep back everything and try and use everything in a creative way. We're actually, we use the bones to make bone broth, bones for dogs. We render down the organ meat to make dog treats. And people like you love having the feet as well. So we try and use every part of the animal that we
can. Well, I can see in your, you know, that you're selling the skin and the pork back fat, the ears. I'll have to order some ears pretty soon. I haven't done ears for a while. So here's the thing that we need to explain to our audience, what scalding is. So not every local small processor has a scalder. And in order to actually sell pig's heads, pig's feet, and certain the ears and other bits like that, they have to be scalded. It's a sanitation requirement. So tell us about the scalding.
Yeah, so it's basically a way to get all the hair off. And the one we use is with hot kind of boiling water, and it kind of turns the carcass, so then it burns all the hair off in a clean way. The one we use is Paradise Locker in Trumbull, Missouri, and they have a scalder, and that kind of weighed into the options of picking them so we can use the whole animal. And a lot of people have really enjoyed things like the pig ears. And we actually dehydrate those and sell those as dog treats as well.
Oh, well, so the scalding is like really basically a hot water bath, right? And that,
correct, yep.
That loosens the hair. It's kind of like how you dip the chicken in hot water and get the feathers off. Is that an apt analogy?
That works. I guess I should emphasize the this is already after the pig has passed away too.
Yes, of course.
Oh.
Of course.
Well,
it's not like the lobster where you put it into the boiling water live. No.
I wanted to be clear if anybody was if I didn't explain that correctly.
Yeah, but other processors who don't do the scalding process, how do they get the hair off the pig?
I can't say exactly for all of them. I know the very, very large ones do have machines that do it, and they actually prefer lighter colored pigs like Chester White because it's harder to get dark hair off of the skin.
Uh-huh. Well, because you have a scalding process, you're able to sell all kinds of things that are hard to find. Tell us what people are doing with the pork skin.
Yes, there is a package here on your website that says pork skin.
Clean.
Clean. That's good. Yeah, what does one do with pork skin?
So a lot of people would cut it into strips and fry it up and make like pork rinds out of it.
Oh, right, of course.
Oh.
Yeah. Can you do that in the oven, or do you need to deep fry it to get it out?
We do it in the oven at my household, but I think deep fat frying usually would probably make them taste even better. So I think that'd be fun. I don't have a fryer.
So that's like a chicharroni kind of thing. Is that, am I right about that? Is that what a chicharroni is?
Yeah. Oh, there's another thing I have to ask about here. I've never thought about this before. What is a pork cheek?
It's pork
literal.
Cheek is, yeah, it's kind of what it sounds like. A lot of pigs, you know, they're known for being kind of chubbier animals, so they get like jowls on them, so it's like the fat around their face. So it's literally the pork cheeks, and it's pretty sought after cut, actually.
It's the Italian, it's where they, I think they make guanciale out of it. It's very special muscle.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And you also, I've gotten from you neck bones, pork leg bones, actually your pork shanks, which are delicious. Now, so ossobuco is traditionally a veal shank, but the pork shanks work pretty good for like a slow braise, and you get really with that cut, you get a real clear taste of the flavor of the meat. It's really beautiful. And even using the neck bones or the leg bones, I've used it for stock and then, you know, picked the bones out in a nice stew piece. Do you ever sell a whole head for somebody who wants to do head cheese?
I haven't yet, just because I'm taking things like the ears and the cheeks, and mm-hmm. by the end of it, it's
not much else left, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and you have leaf lard as well. Explain to our listeners the difference between lard and leaf lard.
So, I'm not an expert, but to my understanding, leaf lard is more of the fat specifically around like the kidney area, versus lard is maybe a more general term for rendered down fat throughout mm-hmm. the animal, versus leaf lard comes from a specific spot.
Well, and leaf lard is notoriously the best for pastry.
Yeah, and it really is sort of... It's sort of
flaky-ish.
I was surprised. I got some, or I don't know, from some, probably from you, Donna. I opened up the package and I hadn't seen anything like that before. But since I do like to bake pies, it was put to good use. And yes, it is good. Good. Well, you have quite a service provided by Farm Story Meats, and lots of good things besides pork. How has your marketing gone? Was it hard to convince people to spend a little bit more for a very much better product?
I don't think it takes much convincing. I think people already want to do this. It's just more of an awareness thing. From what I found, customers are more than willing to pay a little extra to know exactly where their meat comes from and to get high quality stuff. And we are able to offer a convenience that not a lot of others are, especially big-time grocery stores. We had our business model set up for delivery and shipping even before COVID happened, and it seemed like they were trying to catch up with us as far as the shipping aspect goes. So it's more of just an awareness thing of helping people realize that, you know, companies like us exist and that we can be competitive on convenience, as you know, nothing's more convenient than having something dropped off right on your doorstep. So it's been really nice to see the company grow throughout word of mouth and maybe a few Facebook posts here and there.
Well, and also people have to know that these are pigs that have not been raised in confinement operations, and you don't use antibiotics in their food, and you know, it's a cleaner. It's first of all, it's very delicious. So I am thrilled to have it. And I have to reiterate, I'm so excited about the pig's feet. What I have been doing with them, and this is something everybody can do. You know, you can do something elaborate with them, but there are recipes where you actually boil the pig's foot and then you debone it and you leave all the meat intact and you roll the skin up and you do a very fancy, I haven't done any of that, but what they're really good for is if you make a stock with the pig's feet by just boiling them. I just boil them with some bay leaves, basically a while, you know, hours, right, till they fall off the bone and stuff like that. But the stock that you get from pig's feet, whether you're making a soup or, you know, anything, even just bone broth, I have to say that I call it velvet. It has this unctuousness and this rich texture because there's a lot of collagen in it. And it is, there's a well-known English book. I think Fergus Henderson is the name of the chef. It's called Nose to Tail Eating, and it's all about what to do with different parts of the pig. And he makes something in there called trotter gear, which is basically his version of stock. And he puts fancy things in it like Madeira and this and that. And so I actually made his recipe a few months ago with some of your feet. And then, you know, the skin and the meat from it, of course, I have to say, you have to pick the toenails out. It's a little bit uggy. And there's a lot of small bones. But with your fingers, once it's cooked, it all falls off. And you can pick those pieces out. And then I had the stock, which was a liquid, which when you chill it becomes very thick because there's that much collagen in it. It's like a jello almost. And then I took the skin and the meat that was left over after I poured the collagen, stock off, and I just chopped it up and put it in a, like a tureen, and it glommed together just like a, you know, once it was chilled. And I flavored it, salt and pepper, and then whatever had been in the trotter gear. And it made a really lovely, almost like a head cheese, you know, that consistency of mm-hmm. all the little bits stuck to. So I used every single bit except the bones and the toenails. It's a bit of a project, but it's not nearly as complicated as making a head cheese, for example.
Good. Ray, are you out with the pigs? What's going on with the pigs now? This time of year, in the spring, is that when the new ones come?
Babies.
Or they all year?
No. Well, I was talking to my wife about this. The cool thing about pigs is they come in heat and become pregnant and have litters year-round versus, there's a lambing season, and there's usually, most people have a calving season. But pigs are pretty interesting in that they can kind of have litters year-round, so... on my dad's farm, there are pigs having litters right now, but that's just kind of where they're landing in their cycle. But it's fun because you get babies kind of year round.
So does he keep a breeding boar, or does everybody use artificial insemination these days?
I'd say most people use artificial insemination. We use both methods depending on what outcome he wants for the piglets, if the piglets are going to market or if they're the plan for them is to eventually become breeding stock. But we use a combination of both.
Well, good. So explain that to me. If you want it for breeding stock, then do you use the real boar? Or is it the other way around?
There's no set standard. It's just if a customer is like, I want breeding stock from this specific boar at a boar stud, they might request semen from that boar. Mm-hmm. But I guess it kind of goes both ways on maybe we have a really good boar at home that we want the natural breeding for breeding stock, or maybe we want market pigs from like a crossbred. So like the Chester White sow and a Duroc boar is a pretty good combination.
But yours are straight Chester Whites?
One parent is a registered Chester White.
Okay. And so is keeping a boar around kind of like keeping a bull around, or are they a little mellower?
I would say they're more mellow. They're pretty friendly towards me, at least, you know, scratching behind the ears and stuff. And, I think they're probably a little more chill than a bull, or even a ram for that matter.
Does the boar have to be kept separate on his own at all times until you want to use him?
Correct. Yep. So that's so you know who's breeding who.
Very good. Well, we have to think about where our food comes from. We've been talking to Ray Schmidt from Farm Story Meats. He's got a wonderful operation here and Chester White pigs. Ray, can you give us some contact information? How can we get in touch with you and Farm Story Meats?
Yeah, so our website is farmstorymeats.com. So if you want to do any shopping, that's the spot to go. And my email is ray@farmstorymeats.com.
And I have to say, it's a really easy process. You go in there and I'll say, oh, I need a chicken and I want some pork ears and some pork feet. And everybody has to try the Osobuco pork shanks. They are wonderful. Plus you have, you know, all the usual things, ribs and chops and ground and bacon and brats and, then the beef and the lamb and
good. And they're nice enough to bring it right to your house. Absolutely. If you live close to in central Iowa. So good for you. Wish you lots of success and continuing success Good luck. Good luck. We've been talking to Ray Schmidt. He knows a lot about pigs. Yes, he does.
Yeah, and brings it right to your door. Good. Thanks, Ray.
Yep, thank you for having me.
Okay.
You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. The Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about pork. It's good to get to know your pork. Yes, it is. And it's also spring. Now, this spring season seems hard won. It seems a long time coming. But we've got warm weather this week, and things are going to start, like, popping up out of the ground.
Yes, my magnolias opened a few of them on Easter Sunday.
Oh, good for you. Yeah. I have one. Count them. One crocus or crocusi or whatever the singular of crocus is.
Crocii.
More is coming. More is coming. And all those spring chores are going to catch up with me real soon. So let's consider some things. A lot of green stuff is going to be coming up. And we have an opportunity to use what the good earth gives us. I talked to my friend Ben Hawksh, about things that he gathers and makes fun stuff out of. He talks about cordials. He talks about a surprisingly green cake that he makes. This is a little something from the Donna Lana Kitchen Archives.
My name is Ben Hawksh. I live in Ames, Iowa, and I am a forager.
Good. Yay. We're here with Ben, and he brings me amazing things to taste. Right now, we are sipping some cordials. Tell us about the cordials.
Yeah, so we've got a spiderwort flower cordial. It's basically a fancy name for a soda that ends up turning into a wine and then a vinegar. Spiderwort's a prairie plant native to Iowa. It's related to day flowers and some other common household plants that we have. And it's 100% edible. It grows along the railroad tracks pretty often. And it's got these great little purple flowers that are open just for a little bit in the morning. And if you get there before about 10 o'clock, if it doesn't get too warm, you can snag enough to make a really, really nice purple drink. Whenever I think of spiderwort, I always think of their friend, Wild 4 O'Clock. That's another one I see along railroads, and that one blooms in the afternoon. I don't know if that makes a really nice soda, but I always like thinking of those two plants together. And next to it, we've got a kombucha that a friend of mine made from Aronia berries. Give a little shout-out to Global Greens, doing some good work, and happy to be sipping on that one. So we've got a really nice violet purple from the spiderwort and a deep red burgundy from the aronia berries there.
I must comment on the purple of the spiderwort. It's a color that one does not see in the food group very often, but it sure is tasty. Well, I asked Ben to talk to me about a cake that he introduced me to last week, and this cake was green. Speaking of colors, this cake was green. Tell us about this great cake, Ben.
Yeah, so this cake, it's a recipe that I was turned on to by a friend through a blogger called The Wondersmith. And the title of the cake, you know, the article is, it's a nettle cake.
Nettle.
Yep, stinging nettles. Like when you're walking through the bush and you get a really itchy leg and you've got a quick run to a creek and rub some sand on it. And it is inspired by moss. The title is An Ode to Moss Gazing. So this cake incorporates 2 cups of nettles that are blanched and, you know, ice bath cooled to retain their color. And the cake, it looks like a carpet of moss. You know, if you were to lay down below a really nice oak tree in a north-facing slope in Iowa, you'd think that this cake would just be growing right out of the ground. It's
a round cake. It's a layer cake. And the frosting is also green, and it's kind of fuzzy. And you'll tell us how you make that fuzzy frosting. But also, tell us about harvesting nettles. You have to be a little precautious with that.
Yeah, so depending on how much you like introducing, you know, cortisol, your body's immune response to your hands, you know, you either find a pair of gloves or you're cautious to only use the pads of your fingers, because the pads of your fingers don't get stung too often. But, you know, if you're picking things in the garden or in the field, you know, you tend to get them in between your fingers or, you know, on the back of your wrists. And, you know, I do notice that when I pick nettles, I do not wear gloves, but when I go to bed that night, I know exactly what I was doing that day. And you can harvest them, you know, early in the season. They're really nice to grab because they're young and tender. And they've got a whole lot of good stuff going on inside, and you can get a pretty big crop if you feel like processing them. I like to cut them down to the ground because they will resprout. They don't mind, you know, being cut back. And you can hang them upside down in bundles, you know, from the rafters, or you can strip all the leaves off and put them on, you know, drying screens or in your, you know, little dark space in your house that doesn't get too much sun, little air movement, and they'll crisp right up for, you know, recipes throughout the year.
So for this cake, how much, and you use them, you don't use them dry, you use them fresh.
Yeah, for this cake you use them fresh. So went out and harvested about, oh, I'd say a 5-gallon bucket of nettles, you know, and after you get all the stems and the goofy leaves out of there, you end up with a couple gallons. And after you cook those down, you know, in your blanch of water, you end up with, you know, 2 or 3 cups. You know, it's kind of like you get a big bundle of kale from the farmer's market and you throw it in the cast iron and it turns into nothing. And you wonder where that $3 bundle of kale went. So it's basically, I haven't done much baking, so this is kind of one of my first times making a cake, maybe my first time making a cake. It seems like a pretty classic cake recipe. I can go through the ingredients here.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so there's 1.5 cups of shortening or unsalted butter, 1.5 cups of sugar, 6 eggs, 2 teaspoons of vanilla, 4 tablespoons of lemon juice, the zest of 2 lemons, and 2 cups of nettle puree, or spinach puree if you don't feel like getting nettles, but I encourage you to go for the nettles. 4 cups of flour, 4 teaspoons of baking powder, and 1/2 teaspoon of salt. So that is for the cake recipe itself, and that one goes into 2 9-inch cake pans that you greased, and you preheat your oven to 325, so it's a little bit lower baking temperature than normal to account for trying to keep that green color, you know. Now, once you get those two done, you take them out, and you get them out of their pans, and they're a little domed over the top. You know how cakes kind of, you know, end up being a little circular up top. So what you do is you get your bread knife out, and you take off the... you take off the just top of the cake and you let that sit for, you know, overnight. And what you do is just kind of let that dry out and get a little crumbly while you cover the other bits. And the next morning you take that and you crumble it all up and you set it aside. That's going to be the kind of secret to making it look like moss. Now on top of that, we've got the frosting in between the layers and on top of the out and on the outside of the cake. So in this frosting, it's a creamed, what's the name for it? A buttercream. There we go. So 1 cup of butter at room temp, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1 tablespoon of fresh Douglas fir needles. I ended up using some spruce tips. You'd probably, you know, grab a few of them off of your neighbor's spruce tree and get them in the blender for a little bit of flavor in there. 1.5 tablespoons of grapefruit juice, and 4 to 5 cups of powdered sugar. So I added a couple extra ingredients in there for the frosting. We put a little bit of fresh mint and then a little herb called pineapple weed. Pineapple weed's a cool little friend. It grows in, you know, kind of gravelly ditches and parking lots and in the cracks of sidewalks. It looks, you know, like chamomile. It's about 6-8 inches tall when they get really big. They're usually just about 2 or 3, depending on where they grow. And they got little fern-like leaves, and they've got little yellow buttons up top. And when you crush the leaves and the flowers, they smell pretty close to a pineapple. So we put some of that into the frosting as well. And once you get all that mixed up, you know, you're kind of ready to assemble the whole beast.
Good.
So what you do is you get yourself a nice platter, or if I was thinking ahead, I would have cut a round out of a log to make it look like it was even supposed to be growing there, and lay down your first layer of cake, and then you can frost that with your buttercream, with your infused herbs. Lay down your second layer, frost that one as well, and then you take that special little set aside container of crumbled cake bits from the top, and you'd make that really fine between your hands, and you kind of use one hand to crumble it up and use the other to cup the side of the cake and kind of spin it around and pat it all together, and it's just enough to cover that whole thing and make it look like it's alive. Now to top it all off, if you can run outside and grab a pine cone or two, or maybe some little yellow mustard flowers or a violet flower or some daisies to put on top, maybe a red clover to make it look like it just grew out of the ground, that's even better.
This was a lovely cake. It was just had a wonderful surprise. The fuzziness, the green fuzziness, and this, listeners, I must tell you, this was green. Green, and beautiful green. And it was a very tasty cake, because who could not like buttercream frosting? So, probably the unfamiliar ingredients are nettles.
Yep.
And pineapple weed and mint and...
There was the Douglas fir needles it recommended, or spruce needles or pine needles. You know, that's kind of a seasonal thing you've kind of got to get after. It adds a really nice level to the frosting that you really can't get anywhere else. So,
and these are, you only use the very ends that are soft and new, right?
But you have a time period from probably, you know, April through May, once they really start growing, to kind of get a hold of those. And you'll notice it if you just keep your eye out for those evergreen trees and you see those lime green little flashes that are kind of dangling off the ends. Those are the bits that make really nice teas, or you can mix them with salts to put on different things, or pack them in sugar. The thing is, when you're harvesting them, you don't want to grab from the terminal bud, which is the one that's going to keep elongating that stem or that branch. You want to grab the side ones, because that's going to help the tree keep a nice form and keep those branches growing straight. So keep those terminal ones in place and harvest the little side shoots if you're going to be out picking.
New ingredients, and actually old ingredients used in a new way. This was a great cake, Ben. Thanks for sharing.
And no worries. Thanks for having me.
Good. That was Ben Hawks talking about a very spring-like experience. Who would have thought? It was one of the prettier cakes I've ever seen. And
it really was.
Yeah.
You know, getting that color of green from a natural product is not easy, because nettles, once you blanch them, often turn kind of grayish.
Yeah, like a lot of green
things,
you know.
Yeah, right.
Think of kale, or
right.
Yeah. So a light touch and done well. And so she talked about cordials too this time of year. The April, May, that it's a special time of year.
Lana, what do you think? Are we 2 weeks till nettles maybe start?
I haven't seen any yet. A good rain would be appreciated, but like I said, all these little green things are coming up in the garden, in the flower beds. Yes, it's good. And I would have never thought of using fir tips or pine tips either. Mm-hmm. See, you always learn new things. Oh, this is good. This is good. Well, you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Community Radio, and you can find out more about the Donalana Kitchen at www.khoifm.org. You can find out a lot about this radio station and all the fine programs here, and we're there. Look under Talk Programs. You can find old shows. You can find recipes. You can find a picture of us if you just can't get enough of us. So,
and our podcast.
And our, we have a podcast now, too.
Yep.
So if you just can't get enough of us. So we'll go back and listen to a little bit more of music by the Barn Owl Band. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Spring. Spring things. Donna, what kind of spring things are you hungry for?
Well, this is coming. Actually, you'll find all this stuff in the stores now. There's asparagus everywhere. But, of course, we will be, you know, within a month, we'll have it in the farmers markets, and it will be great. So, but you can start eating asparagus now, and, of course, radishes and all of those things. So, I couldn't wait, so I've been buying asparagus. And there's so many things you can do that, you know, the classic is you just rinse it and steam it. And don't overcook it, right? You want it to have a little snap left to it. My favorite way of cooking asparagus is to actually take a sheet pan and just give it a light bit of olive oil and put it in a fairly hot oven so you're giving it a quick broil. Put a little salt on it if you want, or even some lemon zest as it's cooking. And then, you know how asparagus, it will overcook very quickly. So if you're, like, cooking it in water and steaming it, you can quick blanch it in cold water to stop the cooking. But when you're roasting it in the oven, what I do is you don't overcook it. You just keep an eye on it. It goes faster than you think, especially if the oven is preheated. And it will also depend on the thickness of the asparagus, too, right? The skinny ones obviously cook faster. But once it's cooked, just barely cooked, I pull the tray out and I just unroll all of the asparagus right onto the counter. So I'm taking it off of the hot pan, out of the hot oven, off of the hot pan, and then I spread it out so it cools as quickly as possible. And that's the quick way to do roasted asparagus. Put them on the grill, same thing. The other thing, of course, like I was thinking this week, I'm going to do a stir fry with asparagus. You know, something that is a quick cook. You know, and you can cut them into, you know, little slanted pieces and use them in lots of Asian stir fry kinds of recipes or on pastas. I mean, there's just, it feels good to be eating something green and fresh this time of year. And, of course, it does produce that, in some people, the unusual odor after you've eaten it.
But it's good for you.
It's very good for you, and it's very spring, and I'm really, you know, I'm ready for the asparagus. And the other thing that I'm sure by the time we get to the farmer's market, is it May 1st? Or?
Yeah. At least, I think.
Somewhere around there.
That's in Ames. There are other markets opening. Yeah, good.
But there will be lots of radishes.
Oh,
it's always the first thing up. And, you know, radishes can be cooked, too.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a little vegetable. Or the The French eat their radishes with salt and butter. There's a particular way they clean them, and they leave a little bit. They cut the tail off, but they leave a little of the top part, like the first few really tiny green leaves, and you have to scrub all the dirt out. But then you hold on to them by that little radish top, and they spread butter on it, and then a little salt. And that's like a first course for a French spring meal.
That's very good. Radishes are good, especially for, well, I like them all the time. Radishes are wonderful. But remember, radishes, they grow wonderfully in the early spring. Quick, they need a coolish sort of days. As soon as the summer heat starts hitting those garden radishes, boy, oh boy, not only do they want to bolt really quickly, they get hot as firecrackers. But that has its own charm,
too. Yeah,
they
get really spicy. And they start to get woody, too. But radishes are a wonderful thing to grow with children because they're pretty colors and they grow quickly.
Yeah, they're good. They're good. Yeah. I like radishes. Oh, also, there is a thing that you can get in the seed catalogs now, besides the very many, all different colors and shapes of radishes. They've got ones, the long and skinny ones. They've got big ones called watermelon radishes, which mm-hmm. are kind of greenish on the outside.
Well, and there's even all the Asian radishes, which that's a different, comes later in the season, but like daikons are bigger. They're all radishes.
Right. And there's a variety that I suppose some garden grower decided that this was a mistake, but think again, there's a market for everything. There is a radish called a rat tail radish.
Rat tail.
I mean, that's not really something that makes you think of good things to eat. But you do not eat the radish underneath the ground. Well, you could, but it's just kind of this woody little thing. As all radish plants do, this plant puts up flowers and seeds in abundance. And the seeds of radishes actually, and this variety, or the rat tail radish in particular, makes really nice little pods, seed pods. And those are the things that you pick off and use because they taste, guess what, just like radishes.
And do you put them in the salad? Do you
pickle
them? What do you do with them?
Just eat them right off. I've never had enough to pickle, but pick them off and add them to your salad, or just eat them out of hand. They'll taste like a seed pod. They'll taste like kind of a mini pea pod, but it is a radish, and don't be put off by the name. I mean, rat tail radish just means the little rat tails that come off, little fat little pea pods up on top there.
Well, there's okay. Well, there are the, and children love these. What are they called? The Easter egg radishes? Because they come in. Is this one plant that produces purple, pink?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it works that way. But a seed packet would have.
Oh, the mix of colors.
So
if you plant a row of that, you'll get all kinds of colors. And then there's the, they're called French breakfast radishes. I don't know why they're for breakfast. They're a little bit longer and they're usually kind of white on the tip and red at the upper end and quite delicious usually. And look for the tender ones. And it's, you know, the earlier you get them, the better.
Yeah.
It wakes your palate up for the beginning of spring.
Oh, things are looking good. It's time to plant little onion sets or onion plants now. I order onion plants from a grower in Texas, actually, because they have a lot of daylight down there during the winter months when little plants are growing, and they ship me these little onion plants, and yes, sirree, they are ready to go in the ground, so I'll be doing that probably next week.
Wait, the plants come in the mail, or is it the onion bulb that's kind of like starting to sprout? How does it work?
No, it's little plants. They look like little pencils.
Oh.
Little scallions.
Oh,
and they're all bunched up and they're ready to go, and they look so healthy. I mean, you can grow radishes from seed. Yes, you can. It takes forever and a day to go from that teeny tiny little seed to a very grassy little sprout. And then they have to put on a little bit of heft to be able to plant out.
Oh, onions, you mean?
Onions,
right,
onions, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I like planting onions. It's a spring thing, and that's something I will be looking forward to. Oh, I want to mention again, you were talking about asparagus before. Here's a little asparagus fact from my, I learned this from reading seed catalogs too. Sometimes you have very fat asparagus, sometimes you have very thin asparagus. Now, there's a lot of different breeds and kinds, but actually, asparagus comes in male plants and female plants.
Oh,
I believe it. Remember, if you let an asparagus go to seed, you get all this business up on top, it gets all frizzy and fuzzy and that. So it's the males and females trying to, as they say, get it on for the next year. So I believe the fat asparagus, I don't remember which is it. I think the fat asparagus is the females and the skinny ones.
Well, we don't really know. As long as the asparagus
don't
know what
but
they're
but
doing,
there is
you
a
know, it's fine.
There is a difference there. Asparagus is usually, you can get, they're called crowns and plant them. It's the root, kind of the root pod that comes
and
up.
It and it comes up, it takes a few years to get going, and then it comes up every year.
That comes up every year.
Did you start some or you don't have asparagus?
I don't have asparagus in my brain. I have tried and I think other people, I like to do onions, I like to do and tomatoes and peppers. Asparagus, I let somebody else grow them.
Not your thing.
Who does it a lot better than me. Although there's always some that volunteer from my past experiences, past garden experience. Ah, very good. Very good. Anyway.
Don't forget the classic asparagus, hollandaise sauce, and you cook the asparagus however you want, grill it, boil it. Make a little bundle, you wrap some prosciutto around it, and then you pour hollandaise sauce over it.
Do we like spring or what?
We like hollandaise sauce and prosciutto on our asparagus.
There we go. Well, thanks for joining us today. We've been talking about getting to know your pork. We've been talking about spring things and asparagus and radishes. We talked to Ray Schmidt from Farm Story Meats. We learned about pigs. Yes, we did. Thanks to Ray for being with us today. I want to take this opportunity to let you know this weekend, this very weekend, Friday, April 14th, April 15th, and April 16th, that's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we are having a book sale, a fundraiser book sale here at the radio station in downtown Ames, corner of 6th Street and 7th Avenue, 6th and 7th, whatever it is.
Douglas.
Yeah, Douglas. Oh, Douglas Avenue. Douglas Avenue. 622 Douglas Avenue. Thank you, Donna. This is community radio, and this book sale is, take my word for it, it is really growing. There are books all over the place here. So come and support your radio station. Very good. We're here in the studio with our engineer, Mike, but if I just look out the little studio window into another room here, we've got books for everybody.
Well,
here.
Aren't there other records and...
Oh, it's CDs and all kinds of things. Oh,
that kind of sort of thing.
Come get a deal on all of this stuff because everybody has a different taste, and you'll be able to find something to please you. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Today we had music by the Barn Owl Band. You heard the Gaspé Reel and Reel Traditionnel, two French little items there. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find us anytime at noon and 7 p.m. repeated at khoyfm.org or go to the Donna Lana Kitchen podcast. My name is Lana Noctica.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.